is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This week, Donald Trump became the first president of the United States to be impeached twice.
He must go. He is a clear and present danger to the nation that we all love.
They want to cancel the president.
Mr. Speaker, we are debating this historic measure at an actual crime scene.
I inform the House that Mr. Blumenauer will vote yes on H.R.S. 24. As the member designated by Mr. Liu pursuant to H.R.S. 8, I inform the House that Mr. Liu will vote yes on H.R.S. 24.
It's yet another unprecedented event in a presidency that has been absolutely full of them. But Trump's time is coming to an end, and he leaves to Joe Biden enormous challenges. The unending death toll of COVID-19 first and foremost, the economic crisis of the shutdown, the consequences of a four-year assault on democracy and the rule of law, and meanwhile, the Senate will be occupied with the first-ever impeachment trial of a former president. Susan Glasser is our Washington correspondent. Hi, Susan. How are you?
Hi, David. Thanks so much.
We're talking on Thursday morning, and you were inside the Capitol during the impeachment vote. Can you give us a sense of the mood in the building? What was it like all around in the lobbies and the foyers and all the rest?
Well, you know, David, for me it was really unsettling and jarring. My first job out of college was working in Washington on Capitol Hill as a reporter for a roll call newspaper. And, you know, every time I went into that Capitol, it was a powerful experience. It is maybe not obvious to those who don't go in there all the time, but it is not just a historic building, but it's a gorgeous building whose very kind of majesty tends to inspire. And so after sort of spending a week absorbing the images of the rampaging mob to go in there, the thing that was really unsettling was it's now a fortress. It is now surrounded by an occupying army. There are tens of thousands of troops now in the Washington area, more than even there are U.S. troops in Afghanistan and Iraq combined at the moment. And you go inside the Capitol, and there are these National Guardsmen in fatigues toting long guns, assault weapons. It's very intimidating. But you go inside, and the thing that you notice is the silence and the uncanny emptiness of this place that's normally bustling with activity and tour groups and members of Congress to and fro and staffers and reporters. And it's this incredible open interplay, unlike the rest of Washington, which is generally very closed. So that's all gone, more or less.
Now, you spoke to Jeff Van Drew, who's a Republican from New Jersey. Let's play a clip from that.
So just on this day, do you believe now that Joe Biden was elected president of
yes.
the United States legitimately?
Yes.
Do you believe that Americans should have faith in that process?
I think Americans are having a difficult time having faith in the process because we have altered it in so many ways and we're not listening or obeying the rule of law that we need to do.
Jeff Van Drew is a very interesting character because, first of all, he's this sort of very flamboyant figure, dressed up in this almost technicolor three-piece suit, having this conversation. He is the only Democrat who has the distinction of having switched parties to become a Republican because of his strong support for Donald Trump. To me, this was a sign, this conversation was an example of the incredible gap in not just our politics, but in the actual reality and the world that Republican members of Congress are living in versus the world that Democratic members of Congress are living in. And I was sort of having this back and forth with him, like, Congressman, first of all, I asked him, do you recognize Joe Biden's victory? Because people may not realize the vast majority of Republicans in Congress never acknowledged that Joe Biden won until after the storming of the Capitol, until after they voted. Many of them actually voted hours after the storming of the Capitol to continue to attack the Electoral College results and to therefore say that Biden is not a legitimately elected president.
I have to ask you, it seems like 15 years ago, but it's only a year ago that there was a first impeachment of Donald Trump, which you covered. Did the tone or the temperament of everyone in the building feel very different this time around, and how?
The short answer is both yes and no. And yes, in the sense that It was just a year ago, somebody said, well, I didn't realize that impeachment was about to become an annual national ritual. There's only been four impeachments of a president in history. Now, two of them have been of Donald Trump. So something that was incredibly rare has this bizarre feeling of now becoming almost a political commonplace, which is a striking development in and of itself. You know, Nancy Pelosi, who is very adept at the symbolism of politics, chose to wear the exact same outfit for this impeachment, knowing she would be very photographed, that she did for the first impeachment. And of course, that was immediately remarked upon. And I think the message is a very somber black dress. The message I got from that and from talking with Democratic members yesterday was sort of a combination of a deep and profound sadness that this is where we are, continuing alarm about the threats to the Capitol, but also the undercurrent here is, we told you so. We told you so. And of course, that's Adam Schiff's famous speech from the end of the first impeachment trial, which is, he's going to do it again.
He's going to do it again, and he will never change. And we're fools to think otherwise, right?
Yes, exactly. I've been thinking about that a lot, that speech, since the end of the election, actually, when it was clear that Donald Trump was going to do what no president in the United States has ever done and attack the legitimacy of the election and refuse to accept the outcome. That in and of itself was the unprecedented thing. But this crisis, therefore, has been going on ever since the election. I believe since literally that moment, I wrote a column for The New Yorker in the middle of the night, overnight of that election night that appeared on November 4th, saying Donald Trump may have lost, but he is still the president of Red America, and these people are going to follow him over the cliff of constitutional denialism. And it just didn't seem real to people, I think, until that horrible storming of the Capitol.
Now, not every congressman and congresswoman did follow him over the cliff in this second impeachment vote. 10 Republicans joined the vote to impeach. What political price will they pay, and why weren't there more of them?
Well, that is the question. I think that I understand there are two almost diametrically opposing ways of looking at this impeachment. One is, well, this was the most bipartisan impeachment ever. And it is true that this is the largest number of members of a party voting to impeach a president from their own party, 10. The previous record was 5 during Bill Clinton's impeachment in the Monica Lewinsky affair. But look, nearly 200 Republican members of Congress, 197 Republicans versus 10. So, you know, I'm not that good at math, but even I can, you know, look at that and say, I understand where the weight of the party is. So the biggest person to defect from Donald Trump, of course, in this vote was Liz Cheney, the number 3 ranking House Republican, the daughter of the former vice president. Cheney, for some time, has made it clear, especially since the election, that she was deeply uncomfortable with Trump's attacks on the institutions. So I wasn't surprised in a way. But of course, immediately there are calls for her to be removed from her leadership post. I think that will be an early sign of what happens. But the truth is that if you want to know how big is the institutionalist wing, the Republican establishment wing of the House GOP, the answer is it's almost infinitesimally small.
It's a mystery to me what Mitch McConnell actually wants. He has signaled to the press that he was fine with impeachment, which in stark contrast to the first time around. And yet it's not clear that he would vote to convict or whether he even has the influence to whip 17 votes in favor of conviction. What does he want to come out of this?
Look, I think he would want Donald Trump to be gone, banished, done, over as a factor in his party. I also think that Mitch McConnell is ultimately an institutionalist for whom Senate Majority Leader was always the highest calling. And Donald Trump just destroyed his Senate majority by his behavior in the Georgia Senate races and took away the only job that Mitch McConnell ever wanted. The reports are that Mitch McConnell is done and finished with Donald Trump. So, however, he can still count votes. And the bottom line is that the House Republicans, despite these signals emitting from McConnell world, did not go along with a breakout So Mitch McConnell, I think, made a significant decision that he wasn't going to hold a Senate trial right away, but was going to wait until the Biden presidency.
Meanwhile, as they say in movies, Joe Biden will be president of the United States come next week, and he faces all the challenges that we know. Is there going to be a first priority, or does he have to do many things at once? What are you hearing from the Biden people?
You know, David, what's so remarkable about this transition and the fact that we're just days away from the inauguration of a new president, there's so much mayhem and chaos, it's been hard even to focus on it. And so his first priority in some ways is actually the more amorphous one that's the theme of his inauguration, American unity. And the question of can he at least appear to change the direction of our divided politics. The events of the last week made that much harder to do, it seems to me. In a specific sense, the pandemic, of course, is the top priority and will continue to be, I think, for many months into it. They've said that they will bring a new COVID relief package to the floor of the newly Democratic Senate as their first piece of business. Biden has already laid out in quite significant detail, some changes that he plans to make. But first of all, just having a national approach to the pandemic in and of itself is a change. Internationally, there is also a big agenda that will start on day one, including rejoining the Paris Climate Accords. There will be the question of what to do about Iran and the nuclear deal. Can it be returned to? There is an arms control treaty with Russia that expires in just a few weeks. So there's a huge agenda of announcing to the world that America is back in some significant way as a partner to its allies and also as an adversary to its adversaries again.
Susan Glasser has been writing our column, and brilliantly, I should say, Letter from Trump's Washington, and she's been doing it since 2017. And now, soon, she'll begin writing a column called Letter from Biden's Washington. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, David. The transition, I guess, in the column begins at 12:01 p.m. next week.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. We'll be talking more about the transition of power in Washington. Reporter Luke Mogelson joins me just ahead. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The threat of violence during the inauguration is hanging over the United States like some sort of ugly cloud. The FBI warns of armed protests in every state capital. In Washington, 20,000 National Guard troops will be deployed, as though we were at war somehow. American carnage, indeed.
When he said, "We're going to the Capitol," it was like the entire crowd had already been primed to know exactly what he meant and what they were going to the Capitol to do. That felt pretty clear to me.
Luke Mogelson has been reporting for The New Yorker about the right-wing uprising against the election. And he was at the Capitol during the riot, writing everything down and recording things with his phone.
As we approached the Capitol grounds, there were already violent confrontations between the riot police at the base of the Capitol steps and protesters who had arrived before Trump had even finished his speech. And they were deploying tear gas and pepper spray and flashbang grenades. But again, there were just too many Trump supporters, and they were determined to get through.
USA! USA! USA!
Now, you made your way into the Senate chamber.
We pay for it. This is our house.
What did you see and hear? What were these people saying? What did they want?
Well, it was extremely surreal.
They left in a hurry, didn't they?
And it contrasted pretty starkly with the scene outside of the Capitol, because inside the Senate chamber, there were very few people and it was quiet. Once people were inside the Capitol, they were searching for lawmakers, members of Congress, senators. And after they realized that the lawmakers had already been evacuated from the building, they didn't really know what to do
with themselves. But they were searching for them toward what end? Because we did hear reports of cries of, you know, hang Mike Pence and similarly disgusting things directed toward Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah. Nobody explicitly stated to me or to each other that I observed what their intent was, what they were going to do to the lawmakers if they found them. But it seemed pretty clear to me that their lives would have been in danger. That seems like a safe deduction to make.
I don't mean to make light of this at all, but in your description of things, not least in the Senate chamber, the people there seemed like lost souls. A guy sits down in the Senate chamber and he says, I've got to call my dad. And people taking selfies of themselves. There's a quality not only of rage, but in some circles of lostness, of something really both ugly, but also colossally foolish.
Once they were inside the chamber, they really didn't know what to do with themselves. And they were making crass jokes, taking selfies. Rifling through the senators' desks, looking for incriminating documents, misunderstanding pretty much every document that they did come up on.
Look here, look.
Ted Cruz's objection to the Arizona.
His objection. He was going to sell us out all along.
Really?
What? Objection to counting electoral votes of the state of Arizona.
Can I get a photo of that? Wait, no, that's
actually okay. Okay. All right, okay. I'm pissed. He's with us.
He's with us.
He's just pissed. Don't do that!
Most of the people that initially entered the Senate chamber left after 10 or 15 minutes because they got bored and didn't know what to do. One guy joked, we might as well set up a government while we're here. A couple people gave speeches from the vice president's chair.
As if they were in a school play or something. In some ugly, horrific way.
It had that quality to it.
Unbelievable. Luke, it's hard to ask a reporter whose main job is to tell us what you see right there, and prediction is a low form of journalism, but is January 6th the end of this or the beginning of a chronic, frightening problem in American life when it comes to this kind of pro-Trump, America first, white nationalist, violent, potentially movement?
I would guess the latter. I think that it would not be prudent to assume anything else or prepare for anything less. At the end of the night, after the National Guard had finally managed to expel the last of the rioters from inside the Capitol, several mobs kind of shifted their attention to the broadcast journalists who had set up outside and chased them off, smashed their equipment. And at some point, everybody was standing around in an almost ritualistic type circle surrounding the this heap of smashed camera equipment, and a man gave a speech to everybody telling them that this was the beginning of a new civil war and that they needed to go home, go storm their respective capitals, go hunt down the traitors, hunt down the enemies of the people, make lists, and kill them, kill the traitors. And, you know, since Parler has been deplatformed and the FBI has launched this massive national investigation trying to identify and track down the people who participated in the attempted insurrection, a lot of them have gone to ground. But if anything, I think that the people we need to be most worried about were galvanized by January 6th, not humbled by it.
Remarkable. You can find Luke Mogelson's article, Among the Insurrectionists, at newyorker.com. One of the things we've been struggling with so much during the revolt against the election is the role of the QAnon conspiracy theorists. QAnon diehards were in the vanguard in the assault on the Capitol, and a great many people are interested in or even sympathetic to their claims, including a couple of new members of Congress. And yet the term conspiracy theory, it doesn't quite cover the depths of QAnon. Its believers see Democrats not as a political party, as an opposition, but as a cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who are going to be vanquished in a kind of holy war led by Donald Trump. How is something so fantastical, so deranged, so seemingly marginal come this close to the mainstream? The New Yorker's Monica Rasik has been looking into this.
I'm Monica Rasik. I'm the digital director at The New Yorker, which means I spend a lot of my time trying to figure out how to engage an audience. And QAnon, it has to be said, has certainly captivated an audience to a degree that's become extremely dangerous. For those fortunate enough not to know, QAnon is a conspiracy theory movement that started on 4chan, an internet message board, a user calling themselves Q, supposedly because they've got top secret Q-level security clearance, started posting these enigmatic messages. Things like, why did Soros donate all of his money recently? Fast forward 3 years later, and there's a huge community of people who work together to decode these messages. And what they believe Q is trying to tell them is that there's a massive international conspiracy of global elites that's threatening America. So I was doing a little bit of reading, and a colleague slacked me a Medium article by a game designer named Reed Berkowitz.
I am a game designer, and I research games and fiction and media. And so obviously when I saw what was going on with QAnon, it sparked my interest right away.
Reed makes alternate reality games, or ARGs, which are a kind of role-playing game that takes place partly online and partly out in the real world.
An alternate reality game is a game that often starts on a computer. Everybody is meeting online and getting large parts of the story online, but there's also many other components to it. So there's offline elements, there's parties, there's puzzles. It's a treasure hunt mixed with a good old-fashioned mystery story, usually.
So you start playing the game on your computer, but then maybe you get an email or even a phone call from a character in the game, and that sends you out into the real world to gather clues or interact with other players. ARGs are very good at drawing you in and immersing you in a world, and they've been used to promote everything from big Hollywood movies to video games to albums to McDonald's. When Reed looked at QAnon, he thought it seemed very familiar.
I wasn't the only one to recognize that. Many other ARG developers looked at it and saw and said, wow, this is an ARG or some form of an ARG. And, you know, we were all very upset because it was using our techniques to really hurt people.
How does QAnon resemble a game? What are the tools that are at play here?
Okay, well, the first one is that it's fiction. QAnon models itself after popular fiction. You have a mysterious figure who appears and it starts dropping you clues about, you know, a vast conspiracy that only you can solve. You're the hero. Somehow you're the one that's going to find the children that are in desperate need, or the government conspiracy, or anything else, and you're going to be able to find it because Q is going to give you what you need to do that.
Yeah, it like sets off on the classic hero's journey, essentially.
Classic,
right?
Yes.
You've been given a tip and you're off to the races.
And it also, I mean, the part of the hero's journey that gets everybody is the call to adventure. It's that moment where you leave the ordinary world and enter into the fictional world, which is so internal and exciting and meaningful. And that's what all game designers love, is that feeling, you know, when Alice drops down the rabbit hole. And Q uses that same iconography as well, even though that's a clear call to fiction.
And another thing you mentioned that I thought was interesting is that Q doesn't just tell you the story. Like in a game, you have to actually do something to move the story along.
You know, that's another one of the fictional elements, is that, you know, in a mystery, you're always uncovering the clues and following the signs. Clues are revealed. It's all done in questions and puzzles that you have to solve, just like in an alternate reality game.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the more interesting things, the idea that, you know, these clues are being left behind. Whoever could piece together the quote-unquote most likely reasoning behind it then essentially gets upvoted, you know, whether it's in forums or in conversations or in other chat groups. And that's becomes the canon of what's going on. And it's fascinating how, you know, that kind of groupthink creates this narrative.
I used to research role-playing games, not the Dungeons and Dragons style, but the online version where there's no rules. People just chat, right? The rules were social rules. They weren't statistics like in a, you know, a Dungeons and Dragons game. It was all based on social capital, and that social capital was based on what felt the best. Who came up with the best story? It becomes you know, really a creative project. You're solving something together with your friends, and when Q drops the clue, it's a good time, you know.
You kind of touched on this a little bit, but, you know, one thing I'm wondering, you know, why go through all of this? Why doesn't Q just post, hey, everyone, here's the deal about this massive conspiracy? Why instead are they using the model of and the tools of this kind of game?
Oh, yeah. They're using the tools of the game because it binds people together. So not only does it give you a dopamine rush every time you solve problems or get kudos from your community, but it gives them the chance to surround you with a group of people that can guide you and keep you in the group. You know, even if something, you know, people are like, oh, well, that is wrong. That didn't happen. And you're in this community of people that is telling you, no, it did happen. You know what I mean? They've created a false universe for you, and you're in it. This becomes a community and an activity and a way of thinking, because once you apply it to the clues that Q has dropped, well, people learn that they can apply that to other things as well and do. So, you know, Q has joined all the other conspiracy theories and helped to amplify them, 5G, Bill Gates, Wayfair.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a sense that QAnon is a random phenomenon that's been seized on by a community and it's growing organically. But what we're talking about sounds very deliberate.
I mean, I think that there could have been organic roots to this game. I think that there's definitely organic pieces to the game, but to create those organic pieces, you need a lot of know-how.
And a lot of people and time.
Yeah.
And planning. And,
you know, if it was just a couple guys on the internet joking around, right? And suddenly, for some reason, they could afford to organize, you know, marches in all 50 states and create their own movie. You know, on top of this, you know, they're still producing content. A real producer, some college kid, they burn out within a month. I mean, even really well-funded campaigns burn out. I mean, Nonchalance or one of the other projects that went on for years, they're done. At a certain point, they can't sustain because it's, like you said, there's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
So since you know the tools being deployed here, would it be possible to theoretically reverse engineer a game that uses the same tactics but to discourage QAnon?
Yeah, I mean, I get asked this every once in a while. But when it comes down to it, I don't think, a game can be a solution for another game. Right? I think, the solution really is you've got a lot of people out there who are isolated, alone, disfranchised, and removed of any genuine experiences. And games are a way to provide that. You know, you play World of Warcraft, it makes you feel good about yourself, you meet new friends, you connect to the world, and you can change your you can try things out in your ego and say, oh, I was very brave. I'm maybe, I go to school today, I feel a little bit better, You're never going to beat Q, because Q is not only, a very fulfilling way to look at the world, but they're saying it's real. So I think the solution is not necessarily another game, but what breaks down a game, which is community and building. So in many ways, I think it's almost the community more than the game itself that draws and keeps the Q players. So you would have to create a really nice, welcoming community with some fun things to do.
Right. And so not just, immediately ostracizing someone because they've fallen prey to this, but rather keeping them in the fold and in your circles.
Absolutely. Keep them close. Keep them close. That would be my advice. Just expose them to a lot of a lot of reality.
Reed Berkowitz is a founder of the multimedia company Cybernautics, and he directs the Curiouser Institute. He spoke with Monica Rasick, who's digital director of The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. On Monday, we'll honor Martin Luther King Jr., whose work on civil rights was one of the turning points of the 20th century in America. But King in his time was a wholly divisive figure, unloved by millions of Americans, particularly white Americans, who despised him for his righteous opposition to white supremacy and for his holding up a mirror to American history and our violent realities. The same government that eventually cooperated with some of Martin Luther King's legislative agenda also tried to end his public life. J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI went to fantastic lengths to disgrace Dr. King, to get him off the political map once and for all. This FBI effort is the subject of a new documentary film called MLK, FBI. Here's Jelani Cobb, a staff writer and a historian.
As we see in the film, the FBI opened a dossier on Dr. King in 1955, purportedly out of concern that the movement had been infiltrated by people with ties to the Communist Party. But as the movement grew and developed, the FBI's tactics switched from mere surveillance to an active campaign to discredit King and his work. The film was directed by Sam Pollard, whose documentaries on American history go back to his work on Eyes on the Prize, the series from the late 1980s. So can you talk about how the surveillance of Dr. King began?
The surveillance began around when King started to become a nationally prominent figure in the late 50s, early 60s. Now, remember, the FBI started a thing called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence programming, where they were surveilling and wiretapping, and eavesdropping on people who they thought were dangerous. I mean, it went beyond King. It was also Malcolm X. It was the Nation of Islam. It would later be the Black Panther Party. It would be Angela Davis. Any party they thought that they felt was going to change the status quo of America, they wanted to surveil and keep constant vigilance over. J. Edgar Hoover and William Sullivan saw him as basically saw him as a terrorist, a domestic terrorist. Mm. And they felt like what he was doing, you know, was going to change what America was supposed to be like. I mean, the America of the 40s and 50s, during the time of segregation and Jim Crow, here's America where Black people are on the periphery. And now all of a sudden you have this leader, you know, from who developed his reputation from the Montgomery bus boycott, basically saying America needs to integrate. They need to recognize Black people. And this was absolutely frightening to Hoover and Sullivan and to basically many white Americans. I mean, if you go back and you look at the film, there's the television show that King's on, and the white journalist says to him,
"What excuse or what reason do you offer for this approach of creating a crisis atmosphere in a community which leads to bloodshed, as it has in many southern cities and some northern?"
Well, I think we should see the source of the bloodshed first, and we must understand the real nonviolent creed.
Well, doesn't this crisis atmosphere, though, create or endanger the Negroes' cause by creating among the whites a resentment of feeling that the Negro is moving too rapidly, asking too much so suddenly? Does this worry you that this atmosphere could be created? Or is?
Well, I think this is a temporary response in any social revolution.
Well, doesn't it hurt your cause?
I don't think so.
It's kind of an astounding moment, you know.
It's astounding, man.
the sheer number of times where you see King being accused of creating the problem simply by highlighting that, you know, segregation is immoral.
It's amazing. But you know what's sad about it, though, is you fast forward to today, and you think back to the campaigning of Donald J. Trump, and what's he saying, you know, Jelani? He's saying to his group of people, you should be frightened because these people, these radical people on the left are going to come into your suburbs and destroy your community. You know, code words for Black people, you know, and that communism has been switched to Antifa. You know, mm-hmm. but, you know, they're going to destroy democracy.
Or socialism,
you know,
right.
Yeah, the radical left.
Mm-hmm. You know, James Comey, the former FBI director and kind of embattled figure in American politics during the course of the Trump administration, makes an appearance in this film. And I was a little bit surprised to see him. And could you tell me about how that came about and why you thought it was significant to have him involved?
Well, about 2.5 years ago, my producer, Ben Hadid, who I had worked with on a previous film, said, you know, why don't we reach out to James Comey, see if he would do an interview? I said, you really think he will? All the stuff, all the turbulence he had gone through with the Trump administration and being fired. And he felt like he just wanted to set the record straight about his feelings about the FBI back then and the importance of the FBI, to, you know, to remind him of the FBI's past, the letter to that basically suggesting that King should kill himself.
Unbelievable. In the film, you have a clip with James Comey, describes how he felt the first time he actually read that letter.
I was sick to my stomach, actually. I mean, I didn't throw up, but I felt ill reading it. And that's what I mean when I say I think this entire episode represents the darkest part of the Bureau's history.
And you also have Andrew Young, who worked closely with King at the SCLC. And he recalls the moment where Coretta Scott King got that package at her home.
It was put in a box and sent to Coretta. So she opened it up and she played it. And then she called the office and said, look, somebody has sent a tape in here trying to get Martin to kill himself. And they have a recording of some man and woman in the bed. I didn't even want to hear it, you know. This was designed to upset him. We always assumed that Hoover was behind it. My philosophy about the movement is that unless I saw something with my own eyes, you really have to be careful what you believe.
It's something that people who've studied this, I think, know fairly well, that these things happened. But it's still a pretty amazing thing to think that this happened under the auspices of the federal government.
It's appalling. where they would sit down and create a letter, supposedly from a black person. You know what to do. I mean, this could really just try to destroy his marriage. It's really appalling. Mm. One of the horrific things was that Hoover was enabled to be in power for so long. I mean, he became like a dictator. I mean, nobody can be in power that long.
Yeah, yeah. He essentially ran the FBI for nearly half a century until he died in 1972. You also talked to Beverly Gage, who is a Hoover biographer.
One of the most important things that Hoover did was to create a bureau really in his own image. That meant that he hired a very particular kind of person as an agent, a relatively conservative white man of a certain height and a certain weight. He particularly liked fraternity boys and football players.
What do you make of J. Edgar Hoover's single-minded fixation with Martin Luther King?
I think the rationale, his obsession, was the fact that his brain was saying, how dare a black man is trying to change what America's, the America that I grew up in, that the America that he knew and loved was on a road to change, and he was totally against it. And his first obsession was with the Communist Party, which again he thought was going to destroy the fabric of American democracy. And then when he felt that the King was associated with that, how could he? And then when he learned that King was not, you know, this upright Christian man, he felt that he was a disgrace to his robes. He was a disgrace to the community, and he wanted to destroy it.
And there were attempts to kind of filter this through the media.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But the media didn't bite back then. I mean, you know, it's different. It was a different world. Mm-hmm. They respected people's personal and private lives. Mm-hmm. As you know, they don't do today.
Yeah.
What really also happened, too, is they were surveilling King constantly. And King's agenda started to change, and he became part of the anti-Vietnam movement. Then J. Edgar Hoover was able to get the support of LBJ, who had been a close ally of King before. But then when King basically at the Riverside Church gave that speech opposing the Vietnam War, then all of a sudden he became pariah to the LBJ administration.
I come to this magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam.
One of the things I take from your film is the astounding amount of pressure, the almost unbearable amount of pressure that King must have been under. You know, because he's being, especially in the latter points of the film, being criticized by the younger wing, which views him as too moderate, being criticized by the moderate wing because of his opposition to Vietnam, being, you know, surveilled as every movement is being seen and observed by the federal government. He has that complicated relationship with Lyndon B. Johnson. And then in the midst of this, you know, half the country hates him, and you know, a significant portion of it was looking forward to his death and attempting to orchestrate and organize social reform in the context of that was just an unbelievable feat for me.
It's mind-boggling that he had so much on his shoulders. And you can see in the film, there's a certain weariness that seems to set in as you see King going from year to year to year. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, talk about multitasking, dealing with so much. It's amazing. None of us ever considered that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the FBI had anything to do with King's assassination? And is that something that people you talked to for the film believe?
When I was a young man, I always bought into the idea it was a one-man thing, you know, that killed King. But now as I've gotten older and done a lot of films about the movement, I'm of the mind that it was conspiratorial, that there were more people involved, and possibly the FBI could have been involved. Who knows, man? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know.
Was this something that other people might kind of say to you off camera, or some people whisper to you?
No, Nobody said, the only person who even hinted that it was it wasn't James Earl Ray, it was Andy Young.
Andrew Young?
But he wouldn't go any further when I pushed him. So what did you mean, Reverend Young? And he said he didn't want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
No one else ever said anything about it at all.
So what about now? Do you think that this kind of surveillance or overreach is possible, or that if we had significant figures in Black life, that there would be institutional mechanisms that would prevent this from happening again?
The cynical part of me, July, says, you know, and particularly with the world we live in today, everything is being surveilled. We're being recorded. We're being watched. We're being monitored. If the FBI was doing it back then, they're still doing it today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a true believer that within organizations like the Black Lives Matter movement, there's informants. You know, there's people who are providing information to the FBI.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. You know, I think it's notable that the FBI report that was leaked, I guess, about 2 years ago now, said they were concerned about the rise of a quote-unquote Black identity extremist movement.
Yeah.
Although later in the report, they concede that they don't actually know anyone that fits that description or falls into that category. And it seems that they're just alarmed about the idea, I presume.
Yeah. Well, I bet you they're monitoring people on a daily basis.
You know, King is seen as a respected figure now. Hoover would have been thought of as a villain. I guess, what does that say about the history that has intervened between the time that you cover in this film and our contemporary moment?
You know, I grew up at a time where the notion of being an American was, even as a person of color, to forget who you were, where you came from, and become part of this so-called American melting pot, right? Now people understand that you can hold on to your identity, you can still be an American, but you can challenge many of the things that America says they're about. Now, sometimes that challenging can lead to people saying that this election that we just had, you know, of Joe Biden was fraudulent. Sometimes that challenge can make you say, well, this is what I thought of J. Lew and the FBI back in the 60s, but this is what I understand about them today and the federal government. You know, so what's happened in America, for good or bad, is people question and challenge everything about what America is supposed to be.
Power for poor people will really mean having the ability, the togetherness, the assertiveness, and the aggressiveness to make the power structure of this nation say yes when they may be desirous of saying no. Black people, Mexican Americans, American Indians, Puerto Ricans, Appalachian whites, all working together to solve the problem of poverty.
The film MLK FBI is out in theaters and available on demand. We heard director Sam Pollard speaking with staff writer Jelani Cobb. And the FBI's tapes of Dr. King are going to be made public in 2027. I'm David Remnick. Have a good week and stay safe. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.